G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs as well as CFRC, so thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I'd like to introduce you to Trent Atkinson, who is doing a Master of Arts in Religious Studies. Welcome to Grad Chat, Trent.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. Now, first of all, doing a Master's in Religious Studies, it's only a short program. Yeah. And so at this stage, you don't have a supervisor, but hopefully that's coming.
So it's only a year program, so it's a little bit condensed. So we're just starting, I guess, the winter semester, obviously. So I should have one by the end of January.
Fantastic. And that'll sort of help you. Although you seem to know what you're doing anyway, and people are going to find out about that very shortly. And your topic that you've started is called Muscular Christianity, Religion and Sport, and American Christianity.
Yes.
So do you want to give me a bit of background of what does that mean, and then I guess a little bit later why you wanted to get into that?
Yeah, so in terms of the background on muscular Christianity, it really comes out of a mid-Victorian English idea of, especially upper class English, because typically the types of boys that were playing rugby were at like boarding schools like Eton and things like that, like very upper crust.
Very private schools, yes.
Yeah, very like uniforms and things like that. And it was this idea that there was the connection between religiosity and specifically Christian religiosity, because obviously the Anglican Church, and the idea of moral formation of young men. And that was expressed through, at the time, rugby, which was what was being played at upper crust English boarding schools. And it was this idea that as part of being the right type of Christian man, you had to be morally upstanding, and you could instill in young men morally upstanding Christian values through sport.
Right. So, well, that makes total sense.
Yeah, and it's where we get things like originally, like the YMCA was an early output, because it was obviously, it's called the Y now, but in its genesis, it was the Young Men's Christians Association.
Right.
And it was a place where young men would go to both work out and engage in physical fitness, but also to engage in Bible study as well. And it was about instilling in young men the virtues of exercise and the virtues of Christian morality as well.
So it's the combo of two. So, okay, before we go further, this is something that I'm sure you get asked a lot. What's the difference between doing religious studies and theology?
Yeah, so I often, when I tell like my family members, just people in like my everyday life, that I'm doing a degree in religious studies, their first assumption is, oh, I'm going into it like for the priesthood or for some sort of like religiously motivated thing. And I'm not. So there is a connection insofar in that they both deal with religion. But theology typically is making some sort of truth claim about a religious perspective. And also theology is typically a religiously based education. So in my undergrad at U of T has a school of theology and a religious studies department, which are separate from one another.
Right.
And so the school of theology obviously deals with sort of intra-Christian, like learning and debates and things like that. And they're debating about the Bible and they're training people for a seminary usually.
Right.
And so they're making some sort of truth claim about, we believe everything in this book happened, this is what God said, and this is how we interpret it.
Right.
Whereas in religious studies, we're not sort of making any sort of truth claims about any one particular religion. And we also aren't based in any one particular religion. So for instance, in my undergrad, I took courses on Judaism and Islam and Christianity, and there's not really any sort of truth claim being made. So in an example that I use often is I wrote a paper in undergrad on exorcisms of the Catholic Church and treatment for dementia.
Right.
And so in that research, if someone says, I have a demon inside me, as a religious studies researcher, it's not my job to say yes or no. It's my job to say, okay, you believe that. What is that doing for you and what does that mean? I'm not trying to make any sort of truth claim about the validity of their religious belief. I'm more so interpreting it as, you believe this to be true, and it's my job to therefore say, well, be that as it may, what is this doing for you? How does this work and how can I interpret this? So religious studies is far more similar, in discipline at least, to something like anthropology or sociology, something that deals with people.
Right. That was great. I'm going to have to remember that because I do get asked a lot. Because when I first came to Queen's, of course, we still had the theology college.
Yeah,
here.
It wasn't until 2011, I believe, mm-hmm. that we switched from having a theology college to a school of religious studies.
Right, right. So, okay, well, that's cleared that part up, which is fantastic. So with muscular Christianity for you, mm-hmm. even though you said you did do sports and things growing up, and clearly you got an interest in religious studies. What made you pick that topic? Why muscular Christianity?
So it really didn't coalesce for me until about my fourth year of undergrad. I took a course on religion, gender, and embodiment. It was a fourth-year seminar with Dr. Sarah Gallant, University of Toronto. And I really found it really interesting. We covered a variety of different types of embodiment, types of religions, but 1 week we dealt with, in terms of the Christian context, Christian diet culture. And that was right. more geared towards Christian women, because a lot of Christian diet culture is geared towards women in terms of things like the weigh down or slim for him, and about what a Christian woman, how she should look and how she should take care of her family as well. Often Christian diet books is a very big focus on making sure that not only are you thin, but your family is thin as well.
Right.
And so we had talked about a lot of that, and I'd taken some courses that dealt with gender, but oftentimes those courses that dealt with gender dealt with how religion interacts with women. And my sort of come to then was, well, religion is often led by men, it often deals with men. How then is religion telling men to look? Was by curiosity, because we know what religion says about women. We know that there's, like, you know, slim for him, the way down, all that sort of thing, Christian diet culture. But what is it telling the opposite end of the spectrum? How are men interacting with this? And that's something that I felt like I wasn't really getting. And so that's sort of what drove me into muscular Christianity and looking at how Christianity tells men they have to look.
So how far back have you had to look? Because, you know, is this a new, I mean, you talked earlier about Victorian England with school, Eton and rugby and things like that. Is that really where it started, or can we go back further? If you think, I mean, maybe it's not Christianity, but if you think of the Greeks and...
So there's definitely a lot of different influences in terms of, like, muscular Christianity as, like, we would define it. That comes out of, like, a very, like, Etonian era, but there's always been both a Greek, like, obviously Greek, they started the Olympics. There's a fascination mm-hmm. with the male body and with male physicality and sort of having a certain muscularity about it. But even within Christianity, there's always been a fascination with the body. So before there was ever anything about muscular Christianity or about being very physically fit, you get the Desert Fathers and you get Christian asceticism, which is this idea that you have to sort of mortification of the flesh and that the body is sinful and wrong. And so you would get, especially with the Desert Fathers, people going out into the desert and depriving themselves of food and water and becoming incredibly, incredibly thin and emaciated as sort of transcendence and sort of interacting with the divine and sort of cutting away the flesh in terms of spiritual sustenance versus physical sustenance. So there's always been a fascination with how bodies look and what bodies do.
So what changed in the 19th and 20th century? What things were being said?
I think muscular Christianity is also deeply intertwined with colonialism as well.
Right.
And so there was this idea in muscular Christianity, I read this in a dissertation by Andrew Mayer, who's now at Baylor University, who sort of wrote a very good dissertation on muscular Christianity, of this idea that God gave the earth to men in order to pacify. And so with that, it became moral formation of men through sports, but also exporting that to British colonies. And so muscular Christianity became sort of a justification and sort of was deeply intertwined with exporting this idea of Christian morality to other places as well. And so the British saw rugby, saw missionary work.
Cricket,
obviously, as a way to export their morality to the colonies as well. And you see muscular Christianity in, sort of going back to my underground and diasporic context, you see it popping up in early British India, in terms of, like, Indian health gyms and things like that.
Right.
You see it, obviously, with the spread of the YMCA. You see it coming to America and coming to Canada and coming to other places as well.
So there was quite a lot then being said back then.
Yeah, and there was a real idea that Britishness and the morality of Britishness and the morality of the Anglican Church was something that was desirable and was something that should be exported to the colonies.
So I guess the obvious next question would be, And hopefully you can answer this in relation to the work that you're specifically doing. And you talked about football. So where do you see modern muscular Christianity today?
Yeah.
Because it was obvious back then.
Yeah. So insofar as football is concerned, which is sort of where I locate my work, and like in terms of like the NFL and the NCAA, I chose to do it there just because there is more of a football culture in America, I find, than in Canada. Obviously, we have the CFL here, but it's not nearly the same fervor as it is in the United States with regards to the NFL and the NCAA, and it is just such a larger thing there. And in terms of muscular Christianity and the sort of connection between moral formation, upstanding masculinity, and sort of the religious aspect of it, you see it a lot in the NFL, actually. There are several notable players. I'm thinking off the top of my head of Tim Tebow, who was one of the very prominent examples of someone who was both deeply, deeply a man of faith. He's the son of Baptist missionaries in the Philippines.
Right.
He was homeschooled. He was religiously homeschooled as a child, and his Baptist faith was very important to him. But also somebody who talks about and has a relationship with football that is mediated through his Baptist faith. So when he was playing for the NFL, he became very famous for T-bowing, which was a thing in like the early to mid-2000s.
I've heard that word, but so I've never really understood what it was.
So if he ran a particularly good play, he would run to the end zone and he would drop to one knee and pray after he ran a particularly good play. And that became an expression of his Christian faith in relation to football. And he really mediated and talked about his football. He wrote a book in 2011 called Through My Eyes, which is sort of an autobiography of his life through both faith and football. And
right.
He talked about how God had ordained him to play football, that he felt that he was preternaturally gifted at football and that it was God's mission for him to spread the good word through the medium of football. So he talks about how God gave him dyslexia as a struggle to overcome, but also how God wanted him to tell people about God through the medium of football. So he used his platform as a football player. Obviously, he had T-bowing, but he also, post-football, has used his fame to, he funds missionary trips to the Philippines, much as his father did.
Okay.
He has appeared in ads for Focus on the Family, which is an American Christian group that is anti-abortion. He has appeared in other anti-abortion messaging, and he talks about how he is very pro-life and how he and his wife are very, it's important to them that abortion is not something that women have access to, because he doesn't personally believe in abortion.
Because of his faith.
Because of his faith, yes. And even during, when he was playing football, he became very famous for, during a game, typically football players will wear black paint under their eyes to absorb the sun. And so he painted into the black paint under his eyes 3:16, which is a reference to John 3:16, which was one of his favorite Bible verses.
Okay,
and he
then
went on the Oprah show afterward, because people became very obsessed with, like, well, why is he of 3:16 under his eyes?
Mm-hmm.
And that gave him a much larger platform, because this was at the height of Oprah's fame, to spread the gospel and to spread his idea of what God wanted him to do, which was to spread Christianity through football. And so because of the platform that he had, and because of how famous he was through football, that became an avenue for him to really spread his idea of Christianity. And similarly with other players such as AJ Brown, who currently plays for the Philadelphia Eagles and is actually a very good player. He has been to the Pro Bowl 3 times. He had 1,400 receiving yards in 2022 and 2023. And he also speaks quite openly about how he believes that God wanted him to go into football, that he thought his life would turn out differently, but that God spoke to him and told him that he was to be a football player. And he talks very openly about how his football career was preordained by God, and he talks about how he believes in traditional marriage, and how in his marriage, his wife, and with a lot of football players actually, their wives typically stay at home, and their role is to be the wife of the football player, not to work outside the home, and to be a wife and a mother and to have children.
Right.
And that's very important to him. And there's other players who have spoken about it as well, as having very traditional relationships, and that's a way that he understands God and football, and how he mediates his football career through the lens of Christianity.
So I can understand that when there's a deep faith, but having watched football games and things and interviews after or during it, and, you know, a lot of them are saying, I couldn't have done this without God, etc. And you hear it all the time, and you think, do they truly mean that, or is it because they think they should say it? So is there a difference between what you're looking at and those that feel they need to say it? I mean, I don't know. They may actually totally believe. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say because so many of them are saying it.
Yeah. So I think for me, the types of players that I'm looking at, the players that I have looked at in the past, for them, it's a deeply sincerely held belief.
Right.
I do think that the language of like glory to God and like I couldn't do it without him has sort of permeated football culture more broadly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that for
and some, other sports too.
And other sports as well, for sure. And I think that for some players, it may not be as sincerely held a belief. It may just be something that they're saying because they know other people say it. But for the types of players that I'm researching, it is a sincerely and deeply held belief for them. And they would be engaging in their faith irrespective of football. It just happens that football is something that they're very good at and something that they do.
And that's the platform they're using to spread the word more.
Yeah. And even after, there's the case of Miles McPherson, who played for San Diego back in like the late 80s, early 90s. He, in his post-football career, runs a mega church called Rock Church, and they routinely get over 12,000 people for Sunday service. And so it, for him, is a sincerely held belief that, you know, even though he doesn't currently play football, is still something that he believes in very, very deeply.
So organization, you mentioned the YMCA, mm-hmm. But then there's other ones that came first to mind to me was Athletes in Action,
yeah.
Which is very much a Christian. Their teams, I met them for the first time when I worked in basketball, and there was always teams coming out from the States, mm-hmm. not from other places, from the States, to do these sort of tours and play our teams and things. But there was very much, there was a message mm-hmm. as part of them coming.
Yeah, and there's like been various organizations like that. So there's ACT UP, there's the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and this often starts in college-level football, which is the precursor to the NFL. So
right. In
college football, there's these various organizations like you've talked about, and there's also religiously backed schools. So you think of BYU, you think of Notre Dame, you think of SMU, you think of very good football schools that typically are associated with the church. So in the case of Notre Dame, they're associated with Jesuits and the Catholic Church. SMU is Southern Methodist. BYU is obviously associated with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. And all of these organizations, such as the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, ACT UP, and religiously backed schools, really use, as you mentioned, their playing ability and their players to sort of spread the good word in their eyes and sort of to push a message of, yes, we're doing football, but if we get you in the door with the football game, here's a pamphlet. Wouldn't you like to hear about God as well? And so they're doing religious work under the guise of sort of sports culture more broadly.
So I know you're looking at football mm-hmm. in general, and that's very much an American thing. Is something similar happening in other countries? I know it's outside the scope, but are you seeing this in other areas? I mean, you said initially it started in Victoria in England.
Mm-hmm.
Is it still happening in England? Is it still happening in other colonial, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, but maybe not as obvious?
Yeah, so I think definitely it is happening in other places. I haven't done as much research mm-hmm. on sort of other contexts. I think it appears, at least in the UK, in England and the UK right now, more so in soccer, because that is such a prevalent thing there. They're not as, in terms of like soccer players, there are soccer players who engage with their faith and are very open about their faith. And
right.
I think that it has taken on different forms in different contexts. So for instance, in the UK, it's more prevalent in soccer. In America, it's more prevalent in the NFL. In various countries, if you find a large sports organization, you're likely going to find athletes who have deeply held religious beliefs and who are using the medium of sport to push those beliefs.
To push it. I always remember going back, talking about back in England, you know, the movie Chariots of Fire, where the Scotsman wouldn't run on a Sunday.
Yeah.
Right. And so he held firm to his belief, no, this is not right for me. So, I mean, there's lots of little things like that. You can say, oh, you remember that? I remember that.
Yeah.
Those sorts of things. So with what you're doing, I mean, why should we care about muscular Christianity in a modern context?
I think definitely that there are, so I go back to millions of young men every day, every week, whatever, are watching NFL games or engaging with NFL players. So we had 123.4 million people watch last Super Bowl.
Wow.
And about 50% of the NFL's viewership is men. So that gives you what 61.7 million men who are engaging with football and who are engaging with their favorite players, oftentimes who are you know, talking about, you know, I believe that God made me play football, you know, after a touchdown, you know, glory to God, talking about how they're, about how God wants them to play football and how they feel that God has ordained them to play football. Mm-hmm. And so if you have, you know, millions and millions of young men who are engaging with football and who are also through the medium of football engaging with their faith, it bears investigating, well, what is this doing for young men? Because right now, you know, every week there is an article in The Guardian or The National Post about young men are in a crisis. There's a crisis in masculinity.
Yes. Yes.
People are very concerned about the young men of today, about the rightward shift of young men, about the divide in politics between, you know, young men and young women. Young men tend to voted for Trump in the last election. More young women voted for Kamala. And so if young men are engaging with football and if football is pushing a religious message on a player-by-player basis, I think it bears investigating, well, what is that? What are young men getting from football, and what are young men getting from engaging with football in their faith? And if we are concerned about young men, and if we are to take seriously the concerns about masculinity and the idea that young men are in crisis, well, how do we fix that if we believe that, you know, masculinity is a category worth fixing? And if that is the case, then we need to investigate what young men are engaging with, whether that be, you know, football and religion, or whether that be, you know, podcasts like Joe Rogan, and there's people in gender studies who are doing really good work on young men and masculinity as well. But for me personally, my come to is, well, if masculinity is in crisis, then where is that crisis happening, and how do we sort of work to solve that crisis, or at the very least understand that crisis?
It's a good point, because I mean, if you talk about football, I mean, I know you're talking about NFL, but I think about football in the UK, soccer, and there's a lot of men go to games, fanatical about the game. Some of them are thugs, which is not the good side of, of football.
Football hooliganism is not representative.
No. So I, you know, I wonder whether, you know, with this muscular Christianity, if the, for instance, if the faith side came back into it, whether we would have that thuggery going on, or whether people would watch a game in a different way.
Mm-hmm. And I think also in terms of the faith side of it, it's also like what types of faith you're engaging with. So obviously muscular Christianity is a certain type of faith and really advocates for a certain type of faith in terms of being physically strong, being morally upstanding. But it, in terms of like the types of faith, that's one type of faith. So if you have, for instance, a player who was, had very sincerely held religious beliefs, but maybe expressed them in a way that wasn't indicative of muscular Christianity, and maybe talked about, like, my faith tells me to go and work in underserved communities, or my faith tells me to treat others the way I want to be treated, in terms of having a faith that maybe isn't so focused on the physicality of masculinity and isn't as expressed in a very aggressive game. Football's a very physical, aggressive game. Yeah. I think that maybe the faith element could be brought back into it in a way that wouldn't be as perhaps damaging or as insightful as it is.
I like that point you brought up in terms of helping others, because that's very much into most religions of, you know, what can I do to help my neighbor? And we all know if you've got some sort of celebrity, and footballers are celebrities, them going to an event, you can get a lot more people coming along.
Yeah, it's certainly...
And so they're helping.
If you can bring your celebrity to an event, then, or to a cause or what have you, like, it brings notoriety, like, in terms of thinking about, like, David Beckham, or, like, any sort of, in the UK context, any sort of major soccer star. Like, if they go to an event, that event is going to get notoriety regardless.
Yes. So, I mean, I know you've only really got the rest of this academic year to finish what you're doing.
Yeah.
How is that coming? Are you finding your, you know, how you want to put it together?
Yeah. So in terms of in the summer, it's not called a thesis. It's called a major research essay. Mm-hmm. So it's about 60 pages of research.
That's more than enough, I reckon.
And in terms of the types of research that I want to do for that, I really want to investigate why there aren't or haven't been historically openly gay players in the NFL. Like, typically, every few years, you get one, like, for instance, we recently had Carl Nassib, and then they sort of play for one season, maybe play, like, a game or two, and then sort of fade into obscurity. And so I'd really like to look at sort of the homosociality of the NFL and sort of the deeply, deeply, like, held male friendships and male relationships that the NFL fosters, and how sort of openly gay players violate the taboo of homosexuality in the realm of homosociality.
Oh, that's going to be tough, because I would imagine if anyone was gay in the NFL, they won't mention it until they've finished.
Yeah, there have been 16 gay players since the inception of the NFL, and typically they don't mention it until well after the NFL. Mm-hmm. It's only been in the past few years that you've had even one or two gay players in the NFL who have spoken openly about being gay during their time playing with the NFL.
Right.
And they've not been very high profile players at all. They've typically been for teams that don't really have a shot at getting into the finals. Like, they're typically not major sports stars by any means. And typically the only reason that they become of note is because they're openly gay in the NFL, and because that is such sort of like a canary in the coal mine, sort of like one in a million type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, typically with at least the most recent one that I'm thinking of, Carl Nassib, when he came out, there was an intense backlash against his coming out in terms of people saying, why is he forcing it on us? Other players don't talk about their sex lives like this. Like, it was a very swift and immediate, like, why is he trying to proselytize his lifestyle to us?
Right.
And we often refer to it in terms of a lifestyle. And so for that, I would be really interested to look at sort of how being openly gay violates the sort of like homosociality aspect of it, in terms of football is a very like homosocial and homoerotic sport, right? You get sweaty, you're tackling men. There's the whole idea of like locker room culture and like seeing men's bodies and things like that, and how being openly gay sort of violates that taboo and that line in the sand.
That's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah.
I remember years and years and years ago, there was a rugby player in Australia, mm-hmm. still playing, and he came out, and I thought he would get a really big backlash, and it wasn't as bad because his teammates
sort of rallied behind him.
Rallied behind him. But mm-hmm. if they hadn't, it would have been really awkward.
It would have been much worse, yeah.
So I wonder whether he knew his teammates were going to be okay, mm-hmm. to be able to back him up, particularly in a sport that is very physical, mm-hmm. Etc. So that's going to be interesting for you. But how does that bring the Christianity part into it?
So I think for me, what my sort of working hypothesis is, and what I would like to do more research on, is the fact that I think a lot of the morality within the NFL is rooted in a kind of Christian morality, and sort of the uncomfortability with gay players is rooted in a very sort of Christian-informed morality of the fact that that violates a certain taboo. So I think that with muscular Christianity,
depending how you interpret it.
Yeah. So I think with muscular Christianity, the fact that it has informed so much of what the NFL is, and the fact that there are so many players who have deeply held Christian beliefs, mm-hmm. I think that it would be interesting to look at how those are informing people's uncomfortability and the backlash to openly gay players.
Okay. Again, not an easy topic for you, but good luck with that one.
Thank you.
So, Tred, thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope you've enjoyed it.
I had a really lovely time.
Good. And, you know, good luck with it. I'm sure it's going to be fabulous.
Yes.
So keep going on that, and maybe you can let us know how you go later.
Yeah.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Mondays can be a tough day, but would you like something to brighten up your Monday afternoon? Well, tune in to my show, Dark Glasses, on CFRC 101.9. My name's Daniel Wolf, and the show is now in its 14th year, with a mixture of mainly jazz, but also blues, folk, some pop, even retro pop, and the occasional interview. So that's Dark Glasses, Mondays at 2 p.m.
Have you ever been to Extended Family Kingston?
Stop by and visit our programs and talk to our staff to find out how our staff will support you.
So many things we like best are golf,
doing crafts,
hanging friends,
and gardening.
I like doing everything at EAF. We just love Extended Family.
Visit us at www.eafkingston.com.
come on down to EFK, located at 660 Baggett Street, for a great time. Be a part of our extended family.
Come to the extended family. Come and have some fun.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
From the Wings Archive 2016, a maternity hospital in Israel trying to be a bridge for peace. Today on Wings.
Demographic danger. They really use this term, demographic danger, meaning these women will give birth to many kids. These many kids are going to be, how surprising, Palestinian kids. They give birth to the next terrorist.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hadassah is an international women's Zionist organization started in 1912. In 1913, it sent two maternity nurses to Palestine. Its founder, Henrietta Zold, advocated in the 1940s for Arab-Jewish reconciliation in the form of two states collaborating in an economic union. That failed, but Hadassah's first project grew into a range of medical facilities open to all. The pressures around that policy were investigated by Shana Sheely for this documentary. Originally aired in the series Making Contact, it is co-hosted by Monica Lopez.
It's amazing to see her in your arms after 9 months. I felt so happy, really.
Shema just gave birth to a girl. She went into labor hours after her brother was shot in both legs by Israeli forces.
It's my first baby. So I'm really interested to have a good treatment. But I was afraid.
Afraid to go to an Israeli hospital. She delivered at a Palestinian one, even though she thinks Israeli hospitals have the highest standards of healthcare.
I'm afraid if I go there that they may do something for me or my daughter. And maybe not now I can see it, maybe more after 5, 6, 10 years. And I'm not ready for that.
In Shema's mind, the Israeli hospital would harm her daughter. That would never happen, says Drori Hochner, head of OBGYN of an Israeli hospital less than 2 kilometers away from where Shema gave birth. It goes against all possible principles of care and this hospital's reputation as an island of healing. It's called Hadassah Hospital at Mount Scopus. The hospital was built in the 1930s on a hilltop in a mostly Arab area.
In 1939, the doors opened. Everybody came. The pioneer Jews from the kibbutzim, the religious Jews from the old city, Arabs, all were welcomed. The hospital was meant to be an island of healing for Arab and Jew alike. And here in East Jerusalem, it would be available to all.
Just a few years ago, the hospital was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for exactly that.
Inside Hadassah University Mount Scopus Hospital, it's not unusual to see yarmulke-wearing Jews sitting or strolling alongside hijab-wearing Muslims.
There are a lot of stories about unity inside the hospital. The clip you're hearing is from Reuters, produced in November 2015.
And we truly believe that medicine is a bridge to peace.
And that bridge, she hopes, will one day extend beyond the hospital halls.
This is not exactly one of those stories, though. It takes place inside the hospital walls, in the 6th-floor maternity ward where rooms facing east look out over Jerusalem's iconic Golden Dome and Old Walled City. We'll hear from Israeli and Palestinian women who are avoiding the maternity ward because they don't feel safe being so close to women from the other side. We'll hear from nurse midwives at Mount Scopus about the moments when bringing new Israeli and Palestinian life into the world is complicated. And from a rabbi who was called to the hospital to mediate tension among maternity ward staff during a time when the sacred space of healing couldn't withstand divisiveness from the conflict outside. Because even here in the maternity ward, a place dedicated to unity, healing, and literally bringing new life into the world, maintaining that bridge to peace isn't always easy.
We are people. We hear the radio, we're influenced, and I think we come to work also with our personal package.
That's Dorit Hochner. She's the head of OBGYN for the hospital. She's an Israeli Jew. She calls herself a leftist.
You know, you can't just ignore everything that happens out of the hospital.
Especially now. From October 2015 to May 2016, Palestinians killed over 30 Israelis, and Israelis killed more than 200 Palestinians, many described by Israeli authorities as attackers. People are scared. So scared that pregnant women from both sides of the conflict are avoiding the maternity ward when the violence was at a peak.
I was scared, you know, there's Arabs there. Like whenever they decide, they just take out a knife or whatever they want.
Malki is an ultra-Orthodox Jew. She delivered her first two kids at Mount Scopus, but went to a hospital in Jewish West Jerusalem for her third, even though the Mount Scopus staff tried to make her comfortable.
So when they share a room, they don't put you together with an Arab. They try not to.
That separation isn't enough to make her feel safe.
In the hallway, and when you go to eat, they come a lot. It's scary. I'm scared to go there.
There's no safety. There's no trust also.
Hadil is scared too. She's a Palestinian from East Jerusalem, and she also delivered her first two kids at Mount Scopus. This time, Hadil felt she had to choose between the best healthcare at an Israeli hospital and personal safety at a Palestinian one.
It was really, really hard decision. Really.
She chose Palestinian.
Now it's very special time that all rooms is full, because in the last time, because of this security conditions, people don't want to come to this hospital because the Jewish afraid from Arabic people and Arabic people afraid from Jewish people.
Rivka is a nurse midwife at Mount Scopus. Her name has been changed to protect her identity. She's Jewish. All the nurse midwives here are.
And I'm afraid also I'm going only by my car, not in the buses. I'm afraid of my kids go along outside. I want them to stay home all the time.
Home is in a West Bank settlement, about a 40-minute drive away. Violence there has been severe. A lot of the nurse midwives here are religious West Bank settlers. We are with Rivka now, on the night shift.
I want to come to drink coffee.
It's past midnight, and she's sipping a hot drink from a paper cup. Her lips are pink and glossy.
I feel celeb now.
She's wearing turquoise eyeshadow to match her green scrubs. There are about five other midwives around tonight. They'll all be getting new uniforms soon. Purple. Rivka was the leader behind this cause. You know those people whose work makes them happier than anything? Rivka's one of those.
It's look like a miracle. It's a baby come out. Wow. You just see the head between the legs of the lady. It's very special thing to see a lady before and after.
Some of Rivka's co-workers say she's one of the best midwives at Mount Scopus. Tonight, from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., Rivka's on duty in the admission room, but helps out a co-worker with three patients. One Israeli, two Palestinian. Being there to support all of them is really important to Rivka. So important that she signed up for Arabic lessons with a tutor in her settlement. She knows some words in Arabic related to her work, words like push, but not enough words to really talk. The Israeli Ministry of Health provides a 30-minute translation service over the phone that can be accessed by a toll-free number. Tonight, one of the Palestinian patients has a Hebrew-speaking husband in the room. Rivka talks to him. The hospital says that in 95% of the cases, someone's around and available to help with translation. Rivka says a bunch of the doctors and some other midwives speak Arabic. She relies on them or patients' family members who speak Hebrew when her patients don't. The sixth-floor janitor, a Palestinian from nearby, helps out a lot with translation. Tonight, Rivka smiles big and approaches the Palestinian patients with affection.
All the time I hope it will be make the people closer. They will remember they were together and we helped them.
But I must be nice with everybody because I'm a nurse. But I don't know what these people will do outside. Maybe they will kill us. I don't know.
Another nurse midwife who also lives in a settlement said she's never afraid of her patients. When an Arab woman is lying naked on a hospital bed, she said, everyone can see that there's not a knife on her. Now, it's important to remember that a midwife's responsibilities are different from a doctor's. The International Confederation of Midwives says a midwife's job is not just to provide treatment. It's to provide care, comfort, encouragement, to nurture a woman through the most intimate moment of her life with loving support, which isn't always easy. While all of the nurse midwives I spoke with, including Rivka, say the conflict outside the hospital does not get in the way of their professional responsibilities to laboring Palestinian women, many say it can make the job more difficult, especially in times of conflict when the us versus them thing is even more distinct. Like during the summer of 2014, when Israel was at war with Gaza.
The time of the war and this conflict in Gaza, it was more difficult for me to take care about our people. A lot of midwives have sons there, so they should come here and take care of the people who calls their babies jihad and pray that their sons will be okay and will be saved. It's very difficult.
Because this name said, we hate you, it's our country.
Another nurse midwife told me she worked a shift the day three dead Israeli boys were found after an alleged kidnapping by Palestinians. Her name is Avia. She delivered two Palestinians that day.
They were nice. It wasn't something with them. It was hard, like with this horrible thing that happened. You want something like, oh, I brought a Jewish baby to the world.
You need something to calm yourself, she says. Something like bringing a Jewish baby into the world.
You go to the little boxes in your head, which aren't particularly true. It's like your safe place.
Avia recognizes how hard it can be to separate fear from logic. And Rivka struggles with that too.
You feel so strange. They attack us, and I should stay with this woman.
Tonight, Rivka stays with them. She checks on her patients with a smile. She hugs them and coos at them. She takes a coffee break, and then she goes back to check on them. They're not even her assigned patients. And then she thinks about it.
I think sometimes it's our hospital. It's our place, and I want to help them. I want to give the service. I want to be very humanic to them, but it's my hospital. So my people, it's first.
On Wings, you are listening to a documentary about maternity ward policies at Hadassah University Hospital in Israel. Originally aired in the series Making Contact, it is produced by Shayna Sheely and co-hosted by Monica Lopez.
As far as Rivka is concerned, her people, Jewish people, come first in the maternity ward. The result of that is something she goes back and forth on.
I think it's the same treatment for everybody. It's no different.
Rivka insists she treats Palestinian women fairly. Except for one thing.
Sometimes I told you about the rooms. Only this, maybe. But the treatment, the level of treatment is the same.
The rooms are something I heard about a lot at Mount Scopus.
So we have beautiful rooms, big beautiful rooms, and smaller rooms. When Jewish people come, we prefer to give the beautiful rooms for Jewish people. Some midwives hate it. And I don't know what to do.
To be sure, there are a lot of midwives who appear to work totally professionally, who advocate for equitable care and the same rooms for Israeli and Palestinian patients. But most of the 8 women I spoke with who had been nurse midwives in the hospital said that Israeli women sometimes get preferential treatment, including the better rooms with the better views. A few months after I recorded the interviews you're hearing, Israeli journalist Dikla Aharon released a report saying Arab and Jewish women are routinely segregated in maternity wards across Israel. Aharon called 7 hospitals, including Mount Scopus, and asked about separation between Jews and non-Jews in maternity wards.
Shalom.
Only 2 refuse to segregate patients.
Okay, is it מדיניות רשמית של בית החולים?
Here she is, calling Mount Scopus. A nurse answers. She says something along the lines of, "Of course we separate Jews from non-Jews. We do it without requests from the patients. We're even strict about it." Segregation in maternity wards is not a new story in Israeli media. Reports about maternity ward segregation have been published in reputable papers like Haaretz since 2006. But this time, after a member of Israel's parliament spoke up in favor of maternity ward segregation, Aharon's report became a topic of national conversation. Israeli online developer Dori Adar created a satirical web game called Categorize the Maternity Ward. It's a wordplay on the Hebrew term for maternity triage. To win the game, players swipe Arab women's ID cards left into a dark, grungy hospital room on the screen. They swipe Jewish women's ID cards right into a bright, spacious hospital room. And Yonatan Blumenfield wrote and performed a parody song online based on responses from hospital spokespeople and far-right government officials. The chorus of the song roughly translates into, "Just not an Ethiopian midwife, that's gross. Just not an Arab midwife, and, if possible, just to make sure that in the bed next door, an Arab is not being born. Because a good Arab is an Arab not born." Segregation in maternity wards is forbidden by Israel's Ministry of Health. It is against the official policy of all hospitals. A spokesperson for the Israeli Ministry of Health told reporters that the national health insurance law ensures equal treatment for all patients. Dorit Hochner, the head of OBGYN at Mount Scopus, told reporters that Arab and Jewish patients get the same medical treatment. The reason the hospital separates some patients, she said, is because they request separation. She says the hospital tries to be considerate of everyone's requests. Still, some nurse midwives say a patient's request is not a reason to separate Jewish from non-Jewish patients. One of those midwives is Tammy Daron. Tammy told me a story that unfolded in the Mount Scopus maternity ward several years ago. She was taking her Palestinian patient into a delivery room when a religious nurse midwife blocked the door, refusing entry. It was this midwife's first day back to work after being with her son in the hospital, a soldier, badly wounded during an operation in Gaza.
"This room is only for Jewish women."
That's what the midwife said when Tammy tried to enter the room with her laboring patient.
"I told her, look, there's no connection between this woman who came to give birth and what happened to your son."
Too many midwives at Mount Scopus, Tammy says, connect violence against Jews to all Palestinians. She eventually left the hospital because of that racism.
"Demographic danger. They really use this term, demographic danger, meaning these women will give birth to many kids. These many kids are going to be, how surprising, Palestinian kids, not with us. They give birth to the next terrorist." And you can hear the nurses that take care of the babies, they also say, "Here's another terrorist born."
It's this dehumanization, she says, that allows unequal treatment, like the separate rooms.
"I don't think that she says, now I will revenge. It's not that simple. She doesn't see this woman as a human being. She sees her some idea of enemy. You know, when a woman comes to you, she gets undressed, you see her naked, she's spread actually on the bed in front of you. She opens her legs and it's the most fragile position that can be. She gives you so much trust and take advantage of this confidence is the ugliest thing you can do, I think.
Again, a lot of midwives at Mount Scopus advocate for equitable care for Palestinian and Israeli women. And the hospital denies any difference in the treatment of Palestinian and Israeli patients. But the issue of blocking Palestinians from the bigger rooms caused so much tension among the midwives that the Hospital Ethics Committee called in Rabbi Benny Lau to talk about equal treatment.
I just read the first chapter of the second book in the Bible, Exodus, about the midwives in Egypt.
Those Egyptian midwives were commanded by Pharaoh to kill all the Jewish baby boys.
And then I played with that. You know, I tried to say what kind of hospital they have in the river of the Nile.
He said that the Egyptian will get the most beautiful, spacious rooms with a view to the Nile. And the Hebrew women will get tiny rooms with no windows.
Rabbi Lau's talk took place in a normal staff room. But Tammy remembers the meeting was not normal at all. The room was packed with what seemed to be over 30 people. Midwives, doctors, senior staff. It was tense. The midwives sat in two groups on opposite sides of the room, for and against. For giving Palestinian women the good rooms and against it.
It was very emotional, and very tense. And I think the people who were not from our staff were shocked by the level of emotions. I don't think that in any other section in the hospital there are such levels of emotions towards this issue of, demographic danger.
The meeting ended in people shouting at each other about what the Bible says. Rabbi Benny Lau said the Bible commands Jews to remember that they were once slaves in Egypt, so now they should treat the minorities of their land with kindness. In response, the midwives against giving Palestinian women the bigger rooms cited the commandment that says Jews should take care of the people of their own city before taking care of others. One of the midwives who said that to the rabbi, Tammy says, is now the head midwife. While Rabbi Benny Lau was called in to talk about equal treatment, even he gets why that's hard.
Try to think about yourself living in a situation that everyone, your neighborhood, that is from the minorities, are suspecting that maybe he is against you. Think about more than that. Maybe one of your family, was in a situation of terror act. And then try to think about this midwife who come to her work, to hospital, day after sitting Shiva to her husband who killed in the terror act. And then she see the whole family, the Palestinian family, come to have birth. What her feeling is?
Maybe they don't smile, but they do the same job. Thanks God, nobody was killed in my family. Yeah. And a lot of the people in Jerusalem, in Israel, they have some of the family who was killed.
We're back with Rivka in the maternity ward.
You try to help women to give birth and you get this so sweet baby, so nice baby, and you don't know what this baby will be. Maybe a terrorist, maybe this baby will kill our kids.
I don't understand that everybody in this world is equal, and in Arabic people and Hebrew people and Jewish people the same.
You don't understand that?
No.
But what do you mean?
I think it's our country. Ooh. And Arabic people is a guest here.
To try to get where Rivka's coming from, you have to realize that she grew up in Russia. She wasn't a religious Jew back then, but she was still a Jew.
In Russia, I was a guest.
In 1941, Rivka's family fled from the Nazis. They rebuilt their lives in Russia after the war, but Rivka didn't feel like she belonged there. When she moved to Israel, she finally felt at home. She started covering her hair and praying regularly. She moved to a West Bank settlement. A few years ago, after she took a trip to Poland and saw concentration camps, her attachment to Israel became even stronger.
So I don't understand people that they don't understand that it can happen again.
Rivka compares her family's tragedy to what's happening to Palestinians today.
It's the same for me. This is a country, but somebody take it when the time we wasn't here. So it's the same.
Do you think it's like fair or okay?
This is what we have. These people was born here. Understand it's difficult. They can't go away. But everybody should know this is our country. Jewish people country. Jewish people, and we don't have another place in all world. After what happened to Jewish people, we should to be together and keep each other and take care of each other more than other people outside.
But like, your job is to bring more Palestinian life into Israel.
That's what we have, and we have no choice. What can we do? What can we do?
As a nurse, like, what is your responsibility to this issue?
Just stay human being. Maybe people see us and try to be like us, and then the world will be better.
As the night shift wraps up, Rivka checks in on a Palestinian patient. She seems worried, and Rivka smiles at her. Earlier, I asked how she could be so nice to everyone.
I don't know, really. Maybe because it's nothing happened to me. I hope that the world will be better. And I believe Jewish people must do the best in this world. Maybe we'll change.
3 weeks later, her friend, Daphna Meir, was stabbed to death inside of her home in a West Bank settlement. She was around Rivka's age and a mother to six. Rivka sent me a few pictures of Daphna. She was a nurse, Rivka said. Took care of many Arabs.
When baby born, I say, I hope God bless you and you'll be nice to Jewish. Remember who helped your mother to give birth.
Several months after the story was produced, Mount Scopus midwives told reporter Shana Sheely that segregation is no longer taking place in the maternity ward. This edition of Making Contact was produced by Shana Sheely, with additional audio mixing by Monica Lopez. Advisors were David Cohn, Richard Cosi Hernandez, Dolly Lee, and Cynthia Gorney. Special thanks to Rivka, Tammy, and each woman who shared her story. Tan Feldman, Nahum Begleibter, and the Shani family. Anna Sussman, Danny Zwerdling, Joan Beter, Tim McGurk, the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies. Music by Beware of Safety, A New Dawn, Adriana Krickel, Cuddle Formation, Ergo Fizmiz, Mon Plaisir, Kirill Shirikov, Lee Rosevier, and Quiet Music for Tiny Robots. Additional footage and sound by the Spielberg Jewish Film Archive at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Dan Williams, Jeffrey Heller, and Ori Lewis for Reuters. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. RJ Lozada, Marie Che, and Anita Johnson are producers. Quan Booth is our digital content and community engagement manager. I'm Monica Lopez.
Wings thanks Making Contact for sharing this documentary. You can find their program archives at radioproject.org. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Thanks to our Wings supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Lee Bana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football. And that is a touchdown for the Gales! With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage. Looking for Nico Cuomo! Cuomo! My goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown! Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.
You're listening to Kingston